From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson.
Trying to get a shot for Pulido. Here she goes, and she's got it. The national championship goes to Connecticut for the fourth year in a row as the dynasty fulfills its destiny.
With that win, the University of Connecticut made history. They became the first women's college team to bring home four basketball championships in a row. The team is no doubt reveling in that victory still, but there's another woman who could take some of the credit. She's a little older, a healthy 88, and she was never really much of an athlete.
I never participated in sports because it was absolutely boring for girls.
That's Bernice Sandler, or Bunny as her friends call her, and she bears a lot of responsibility for getting those UConn women onto the court. Let me read this for you. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participating in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving any federal financial assistance.
I recognize that. That's the beautiful language of what's called Title IX.
Dr. Sandler is known as the godmother of Title IX.
Title IX of the Education Amendments prohibits sex discrimination in higher education.
She earned that name by filing the very first sex discrimination case against universities in the U.S. Her story starts like this. Way back in 1969, Mrs. Sandler finished her PhD at the University of Maryland and became Dr. Sandler. But it turned out jobs were harder to come by than the degree she just earned.
I was a part-time instructor, which isn't nearly as good as being a part-time professor. And there were seven openings. There was a big opening in the department I was in, which was in the School of Education.
And you were looking for a permanent job.
Yeah, and they hired seven men.
Dr. Sandler wasn't even in the running.
Didn't even consider me or any other women. And I'm a good teacher. People like me, and I did good work and so forth. I got along and all of that.
It didn't matter.
I went to one of my faculty friends and say, you know, what's going on? How come I wasn't hired? I really thought I was a good teacher and so forth and so on. And he just looked at me and he said, well, let's face it, you come on too strong for a woman. And I went home and I literally wept.
Dr. Sandler says she blamed herself. She thought that she'd done something wrong.
I said to my then husband, you know, I never should have spoken up in class. I never should have made a suggestion at a staff meeting. I never should have. A whole bunch of things that were absolutely quite normal. And he said, well, that's sex discrimination. That's not you. It's sexism. It became clear to me that this was sex discrimination.
But standing up to sex discrimination wasn't exactly encouraged back then.
At this point, sex discrimination is a new issue, and the newspapers very often portray women who are working on sex discrimination as castrating bitches.
Retreating would have been easy, very easy. But Dr. Sandler did something else.
I filed a class action complaint against every college and university in the country that had a federal contract.
More than 250 schools. It took a lot of research.
And going back to World War II, there had been a series of executive orders by the president that said if anyone had a contract with the government.
As these schools did, they couldn't discriminate. It was illegal.
You couldn't discriminate on the basis of race, color, national origin, religion, and sex. And when I read that, I literally shrieked aloud.
In the summer of 1970, Congress convened hearings about sexual discrimination in education. Dr. Sandler's research provided a list of witnesses, including herself. And in 1972, Title IX passed and amended the Higher Education Act to prohibit discrimination by gender in any educational program or activity receiving federal funding. But the words sports and athletics were nowhere in the bill.
We had no idea how bad the opportunities for women and girls in sports was. The discrimination was awful, but the awareness of how wrong it was not there for lots of people.
2 years after the law was first passed, the federal government issued more regulations requiring schools to apply Title IX to athletics too, finally propelling a lot more women onto playing fields, tennis courts, and in the case of the UConn Lady Huskies, into collegiate sports history. There are now five times as many women in college sports.
So when you see girls playing sports
whether it's a soccer field or playing softball or something. How does that make you feel?
I smile, and not just inwardly, but I smile outwardly, and I say, this is so great. They have opportunities that girls never used to have, and it's their right to have it. It's not that somebody gives them the opportunity. It's their right by law. And sometimes I see girls dressed in soccer uniforms, and I just smile.
Not long before the UConn women won their record-breaking championship, dozens of girls brought their enthusiasm, dreams, and voices to the bleachers at UC Berkeley.
I'm Camille Pratt Chapman, and I'm 11.
My name's Emily Sorensen, and I'm 11, almost 12.
I'm Kayla Gooden, and I'm 11.
Camille, Annalise, and Kayla are pretty tight. They're in choir together at the Julia Morgan School for Girls in Oakland, California. And they're singing the Star Spangled Banner before the night's game. But they didn't show up just to sing. Camille loves watching the women play.
So my grandpa took me here when I was younger, like 3, 4, or 5, and then I've been coming to here ever since. It's inspiring to you because you learn new things about basketball that you hadn't known, and so when you go to a game, you get to use those things, and it's just, they're really inspiring to watch. An athlete is something that I sort of want to be when I'm older.
We play softball. We've been playing since we were in kindergarten on the same team. So
I play soccer, too.
Yeah. And we will play volleyball. And, like, because our season just ended, so volleyball's starting up, and we're both going to play.
In spite of all of the changes since Congress passed Title IX, the playing field isn't always level.
Sometimes men would think, like, when you see a woman, you think, like, dresses and heels, and you think they just walk around and shop. If someone were to look at me, they would think that, and so I would have a really small chance of becoming a coach or a player. But if they really saw, like, what you could do...
Well, I don't think anyone's, like, specifically better, but I think that we're equal. Like, people should treat women and men equally.
Same.
Yeah.
That's what Title IX was meant to do, and that is what Bunny Sandler thought it would do back in 1972, when Congress first passed it.
I was much younger and much more naive. I thought that the government would simply say no sex discrimination, it will all stop the next day, and that would be it. Obviously, that didn't happen. People and institutions and policies don't change so quickly.
Even after all these years, we are still faced with these issues. Yes, Title IX brought more equality in some ways, but as with most rules, there's a workaround. Today on Reveal, we look at those loopholes and the legacy of Title IX.
This is Andrew Becker. I'm a reporter here at Reveal. Over the past year, I've been looking into dysfunction and mismanagement at the Transportation Security Administration, or the TSA. It's the agency that's in charge of airport security in the U.S. Most recently, I've written about some pretty outrageous accounts from current and former officials in the TSA's intelligence office. They describe a toxic culture with all kinds of inappropriate behavior, from false accusations of wedgies to forced motivational push-ups to retaliation against employees who reported misconduct. The agency is currently under fire from lawmakers for a litany of issues, from security gaps to discrimination within the agency. There's more to come, so head over to our website to check out our stories, revealnews.org. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at abeckercir.
You're listening to Reveal. I'm Al Letson. If you pay attention to college sports, you know it's been a huge year for the University of Iowa. The football team became one of the surprise stories of the season.
You know, the Hawkeyes are unbeaten. One more win would get them into the playoff.
The team was down for years. That's a big problem because, like a lot of colleges, Iowa relies on football to make money. It built a $55 million football practice facility that opened last year. The team came roaring back with an undefeated season and a trip to this year's Rose Bowl.
Iowa, the Big Ten, comes to Pasadena for the first time in 25 years. And the Hawkeyes brought along thousands of their loyal fans.
Alongside the success of the football team, there's another story, a failure. You see, the school used to be the model for gender equality, but the firing of a successful women's coach has set off a scandal. What's happened in Iowa highlights a problem across the country. Women used to run women's sports. Now it's a man's game. Reporter Annie Brown brings us the story.
We won't watch the whole thing, but you kind of get a little glimpse of just the pride. And
Tracy Griesbaum and I are slumped over a laptop in her Iowa City home, watching videos of her field hockey team at the University of Iowa.
So this is a highlight video that we put together at the end of our season.
The videos are a lot of winning goals and young women screaming over inspirational background music.
Patience, Sarah! Patience!
Tracy is one of the most successful coaches in Iowa's history. She has 4 Big Ten titles and a winning record in her 14 years as head coach. Athletes used to travel from all over the world to play for Tracy. But for now, it's just the two of us, sitting in her basement on a Tuesday afternoon, watching these videos.
Iowa coach Tracy Griesbaum, we have to give you a big congratulations and ask you this question. Are your arms tired? You've been carrying this trophy around for 3 years.
We're okay with that. That's why we get stronger.
And the shot, and it's in! Iowa comes back to win this game! The third consecutive championship!
What's it like to watch that now?
Yeah, it's... For me to be sitting here with you and not doing what I'm supposed to be doing is really frustrating. It's just hard to watch some of their faces, I guess.
Tracy is a tall woman with short gray hair. She used to color it a dark brown, but stopped when everything was falling apart. One afternoon, in May of 2014, the athletic director, Gary Barta, called a meeting with Tracy. Here's Tracy again.
They said that there were some allegations put forth against me.
An anonymous player had accused Tracy of verbal abuse. The university launched an investigation, spent close to 3 months interviewing players, and produced a report.
So here are the few examples of mistreatment reported by student athletes called stupid. It's not in my vernacular. Coach Griesbaum told a student athlete, quote, if I were you, I would kill myself. Student athlete had to practice alone while the rest of the team practiced together.
The report also cited claims that students felt pressured to play injured. Others were so stressed out that they had to seek therapy. But in the end, the report concluded,
there was insufficient evidence presented to substantiate a violation of university policy.
So Tracy went back to preparing for the season. But 3 days later, Gary Barta called Tracy in.
And that was over. I was gone in maybe a 10-minute meeting.
Gary fired Tracy about 2 weeks before the start of the field hockey season. A spokesman for the university, Joe Brennan, went on Iowa Public Radio to defend the decision.
Gary felt that it was his responsibility as athletic director, in order to protect the student athletes, to make that leadership change.
But the players who spoke publicly said Tracy didn't do anything wrong.
A lot of Proud Hawks on 3, 1, 2, 3.
Hawks!
Okay, here we go. 2 minutes.
We visited the field hockey team at one of their indoor practices this winter. For 2 hours, the girls run drills and practice shooting on a huge turf field. The school wouldn't let me interview players at practice. So over 6 months, I reached out to 60 of Tracy's current and former players. I was looking for the students behind these claims, or a student who felt they were justified.
I can't imagine these things coming out of her mouth.
It's completely blindsided.
That's Caroline Blaum and Roz Ellis. You'll also hear Lauren Pfeiffer here, and Patty Gilhern.
She called a player stupid. Did you ever see Tracy do anything like that?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that sounds completely, like, I'm laughing right now hearing that.
What about the word that? Like, do you feel like it's possible that she said that?
No, she could have called me fat. I was out of shape. I was not eating right. And she didn't.
24 students got back to me, and no one had anything negative to say about Tracy. Here's Pfeiffer and Ellis again.
So do you think that the girls are just making it up? Or, like, that they...
I don't want to, like, say people are lying, but she would never have said anything like that.
I want them to say it to my face because I sat in the same seat as you and was in the same meetings that you're claiming you had that she crossed the line. There's no way.
Her firing shocked her colleagues at the university and across the country.
I had a ton of coaches call me and in total shock. My God, if Tracy Griesbaum was fired, I should have been fired 15 years ago.
That's Lisa Salucci. She was Tracy's assistant coach for 14 years.
You know, her nickname is Tidy because she doesn't curse, she doesn't drink, she doesn't really do anything that's inappropriate. If she said, like, damn or something, like, people would, like, celebrate. They'd be like, look, Tidy said damn.
All of Tracy's players published an open letter to the university in the school paper. The team made T-shirts that read, "We support our coach." But still, Tracy was out of a job. Here's Tracy again.
And I asked, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And I was never told what I did wrong.
Fueling this outcry was the general sense that at Iowa, women coaches were losing ground. Tracy was the fifth female coach Gary Barta forced out in 6 years. What's happened at Iowa has come as a big surprise, because for decades, the university was a stronghold for women coaches. So to understand Tracy's story, we have to go back about 40 years.
You've been listening to Hawk Talk.
My name is Christine Grant, and I'm retired from the position of women's athletic director at the University of Iowa.
Christine turns 80 this year, and the fact that she was a female athletic director makes her a bit of a relic. There are only two female athletic directors in the top conferences today. So here I found this collage of the women's athletics department. Do you know what year this is?
Oh, heavens above. That was way back. I think it was 1974.
Because there's so many women on this board. I think that's the thing that's so striking about it. It's like all of the head coaches are women. Back then, 90% of women's teams were coached by women and headed by female athletic directors.
That was a time when it was paying little or nothing. It was women who did the work.
That's not just an expression. Schools really didn't pay most coaches of women's teams. Then Title IX passed. That was supposed to get rid of gender discrimination in education. But Title IX doesn't require gender equality in coaching. So it had this weird side effect.
We were so concerned about what was happening to women coaches and women administrators. They were disappearing.
For the first time, schools had to invest real money in women's sports. And that meant more than doubling the number of coaching jobs. Before, mostly female athletic directors would have hired these new coaches. But after Title IX, universities put male athletic directors in charge of the women's teams. And statistically, men are more likely to hire other men. Things started to change.
The bottom line was strong women were not appreciated. So you either towed the line and kept quiet, or you spoke up and you were either demoted or fired.
It went from 90% of female teams coached by women to 43% today. But Iowa was different. It was one of the only schools that kept a separate athletic director for the women.
I hired the coaches, I evaluated the coaches, and that's what made Iowa very, very different.
At Iowa, women coaches were always in the majority, and they were really good.
Meanwhile, the Iowa women's team is still going gangbusters.
The women's teams won 27 Big Ten titles in 27 years. That all changed when Christine Grant retired in 2000. Iowa finally got rid of its separate department for women and put the men's athletic director in charge. But the school made an important agreement. If the athletic director were male, the number two would be female. Today, that director is Gary Barta. This past year, Gary has been riding high with the football team's surprising success and getting to play in the Rose Bowl.
Come on in.
Hi.
Hi there.
How's it going?
You? I'm
Good.
Gary.
Annie Brown.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
That day, hundreds of students were in line outside, waiting to pick up their tickets to the Rose Bowl.
It's been just amazing. We had 55,000 requests for 22,000 tickets.
Before our meeting, Gary sent me pages and pages of budgets. He increased the budget for every women's team last year. But what Iowa managed to avoid in the past three decades has finally happened. Gary has forced out five female coaches, replaced two of those women with men, and paid those men an average of 25% more than the women. And the women's teams aren't very good anymore. since Scary took over, the women have only won 4 titles in 10 years. And 3 of those were from field hockey under Tracy. When women have been fired and then replaced by men, those men have been paid an average of 25% more. What's the rationale behind that?
Both the experience of the candidate and peer comparison come into play when we set the salary. But it's not based on gender, it's based on those 2 factors.
A bit about numbers here, because I'm about to get technical with Gary. Under Christine Grant, women coached an average of 80% of women's sports. Now, under Gary, only 50% are coached by women. That's the lowest in the school's history.
You know, are we nationally concerned that there aren't enough females coaching women's sports? The answer is yes. But 50% is above the state average, it's above the Big Ten average, and it's above the national average.
But it's below the average that it was before.
I don't know what it was 20 years ago, but this is a national concern, not just a
right,
concern.
Right, but Iowa was the place where this was not true. Iowa was the place where it didn't go down after Title IX, except for after Christine Grant left.
And my answer is again, it's a national phenomena. And so we're at 50%. We want to be higher, but that's above the national average. It's above the Big Ten average.
And Gary's right. This is a national trend. But that doesn't answer the question why. What's behind this national trend? Tracy has a theory about what happened to her.
I was really trying to stand up for what I thought was fair to field hockey, but also to women athletes. And the vibe was that he cared about football. He cared about basketball.
Tracy says she complained about women's sports not getting the same resources, the same attention. And other coaches say she spoke up for them, too. Like Sharon Dingman. She was the volleyball coach at Iowa from 2010 to 2013.
When coaches had something that they wanted brought up to Gary, Tracy was a coach that we would turn to and ask, hey, could you bring this up?
Sharon had a losing record and did not get her contract renewed. Gary replaced her with a male coach and paid him $40,000 more than Sharon. Here's Sharon again.
Tracy just fought the fight for everybody, that's for sure. And he was the only one that had the courage to broach those subjects with Gary.
Even Lisa Salucci, the woman who took over for Tracy, says she doesn't get it.
You know, so many people have said to me, like, if there was such a problem, why would you be offered the job? I still don't know the answer to that, really, except for I was told that we're different people with different personalities.
Do you want to go into that?
I don't really know how to explain it, to be honest. I definitely don't challenge as much as she does. It's probably harder for me to have conversations that are more challenging. It's just my nature.
There was one coach I talked to who disagreed. Felt like Gary has been very fair to the women coaches. Here's Megan Menzel, the golf coach at Iowa since 2011.
Gary has been very supportive of me as a head coach. And, you know, any time that I've had any issues or anything that I need to bring forward, my voice has been heard.
In March, Tracy filed a lawsuit against Iowa, claiming that the school retaliated against her for speaking up. So I went looking for other women who have done this. Across the country, I found 37 female coaches and administrators who have filed retaliation cases in the last decade. These lawsuits follow a similar pattern. A coach notices some form of discrimination and she speaks up to a superior. Then she loses her job or gets demoted. Of these 37 women who sued, 86% won their case or settled out of court. And this is big money. In 2007, Fresno State had to pay $9 million for one retaliation case. But there's another thing I started to notice. Almost half of the coaches in these retaliation cases claim they were accused of mistreating or verbally abusing their players. So I called these women. 4 of them agreed to be on the record. These 4 won their lawsuit or settled out of court for as much as $700,000. And they see themselves as whistleblowers. When they get fired, they're told it's because of mistreating their players. Here's Ruth Crow from Iowa State University.
They tried to say that I swore at my players.
Kathy Bull from Ball State University in Indiana.
You know, they had to stay 15 minutes longer in the weight room than what they should have.
Jermaine Fairchild from Quinnipiac in Connecticut.
Not a healthy environment for young women.
Of all the women who sued, 84% never worked in college sports again. I can't verify that these women didn't verbally abuse their players. But I asked a law professor, Aaron Buzovitz from Western New England University, to help make sense of this. Aaron studies retaliation lawsuits and tracks how they play out.
Oftentimes, the defense against a retaliation claim is the athletic department's counter-allegation that, oh no, the real reason why we fired this coach is because of her being verbally or physically abusive to players. And that's, you know, that's a hard thing to unpack. On the one hand, there ought to be zero tolerance for coaches who are abusive of their players. I mean, this is college athletics. But on the other hand, it could be behavior that is tolerated when it's exhibited by male coaches, but punished when it's exhibited by female coaches.
The thing is, the people who are doing this punishing are the athletic directors. And if you look at the gender breakdown, it's even more skewed than with coaches. 90% of the athletic directors in Division I are men. But Iowa had a protection in place against this. Remember how when Christine Grant left, they agreed that if the athletic director were male, then the number two would be female. Well, that woman was Jane Meyer.
I was hired back in March of 2001, considered the number two person in the athletics department.
Jane served in that role for 14 years. But about a month before Tracy got fired, the athletic director, Gary Barda, announced he was creating a new number two position. He hired a man to fill it and paid him $70,000 more than Jane.
That was sort of my last straw of things that I had raised with regards to gender equity. So I decided to put it in writing.
The following day, Gary put Jane on administrative leave. She now works in the dean's office. She still makes the same amount of money, but she hasn't worked in athletics since.
What I was doing in college athletics was because of student athletes. And I don't have that opportunity in my reassignment. So it's very different. It is not my passion.
This is where things get complicated. See, Jane was Tracy's longtime partner. They had not officially disclosed their relationship at work, but people kind of knew. In a statement, the university said Jane was removed because Tracy was expected to sue. In response, Jane filed her own retaliation lawsuit. She claims that speaking up for gender equity got her pushed out of the athletic department. Now, Gary is swimming in gender discrimination lawsuits. There's even one from the other side. Iowa recently settled a case with a man. He had applied for an assistant coaching job on a women's team, but an email surfaced showing that the department required the job he wanted go to a woman. Coaches aren't the only losers in these cases. So are the teams they leave behind.
I mean, I've never stepped on Grant Field without her.
That's Lisa Salucci again, Tracy's assistant coach who took over. The first day back at practice without Tracy, it was over 90 degrees outside.
Drive up to Grant Field, get out of the car. Usually Tracy would always be there before me, so that was had a very odd feeling. And, you know, our sticks are always hanging on the same hook with our whistles, and hers were still there because she never even got a chance to go back and get them. So that right there was probably like the biggest breakdown that I had, but sorry. Sorry, hold on a second.
One of the players, Chandler Ackers, says she had just gotten back to campus.
It was just so weird standing on the field without Tracy. Like, we couldn't even, like, put our stick in our hand because it was just so, like, Tracy got us that stick. Like, she was, like, such an integral part of the team. She was, like, the face of Iowa field hockey. How are we going to get through this season?
At least one player transferred out of Iowa that year because of Tracy's firing. And Chandler says the rest of the team felt cheated.
Our coach was taken away from us. We had no time to prepare for anything. We had no time to even consider transferring or anything like that. We were basically thrown into the situation.
She and three other players filed a federal Title IX complaint against Iowa. This is unheard of. As far as we know, no student in the country has ever filed a Title IX complaint on behalf of their coach. They claim that taking away Tracy is like taking away their most valuable resource. Here's Chandler again.
It's just not what any male team has had to experience at this university thus far.
Tracy's lawyer, Tom Newkirk, help them file the complaint. He boils the case down to this.
If you take every allegation against Tracy Grisbaum and you imagine to yourself that it's true, the question you need to ask yourself is, if a male coach was engaging in exactly the same type of behavior, who cares?
That story was from reporter Annie Brown. So there are two ways the Office of Civil Rights can punish a school for violating Title IX. They can ask the Justice Department to take them to court. They've never done that. The second is to take away all federal funding. We asked the office, and they couldn't give us a single example of doing that either. If they were to take away a school's federal funding, it would effectively shut down that school. So how is Athletic Director Gary Barta doing? Well, things have never looked better. Iowa just gave him a new 5-year contract that increased his base salary from $400,000 to $550,000, along with other perks. When the Associated Press reached out to ask Gary about his raise, he couldn't comment. He was away on a Caribbean cruise with the football team. Up ahead, we look at how some colleges are staying in check with the law and dive deep into a phrase that's become sort of a bad word in athletic departments, but we won't beep it out. You ready? Roster management. That story when we come back on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, listeners, it's Cole Goins from Reveal. On Thursday, May 12th, we're hosting a live Q&A on Reveal's Facebook page with reporter Annie Brown about the story that you just heard. We'll talk about our investigation into the decline in the number of female coaches and take your questions about inequality in college sports. If you want to join, be sure to like Reveal's page on Facebook. You can also head over to our website to read Annie's story and see how your school stacks up on gender equity. Visit us at revealnews.org.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Today, we're looking into Title IX, the law meant to bridge the gender gap in schools. It's given women athletes more opportunities to compete in college sports. The federal government checks to make sure schools are following the law. When it comes to sports, there are a few ways to do that. One of them sounds complicated, but it's pretty simple. It's called substantial proportionality. That means if 45% of the school is women and 55% is men, the number of student athletes should also split along those same lines. 45% women, 55% men. It turns out that some universities are using creative ways to count. On paper, they're meeting the requirements, but they're not necessarily giving women the same opportunities as men. When we started looking into this, a few universities jumped out at us, including UCLA. We sent producer Rachel DeLeon to check the math.
In a pickup game at a student gym on UCLA's campus, I meet up with some members of the women's basketball team. The women Bruins just finished their best season in 17 years. I shake hands with one of the players, and while we're about the same height, 5'11", there's one big difference.
My name is Preston Dillingham, and I'm a fourth year at UCLA.
Yep, he's a guy. Preston didn't make the cut for the men's team, so he joined what's called the scout team. They're guys who practice on the women's team so the women can play against bigger, stronger opponents. During practice, Preston pretends to be female opponents from other teams.
They'll come to each one of us, say, Preston, today your name is so-and-so, and you're a left-handed shooter.
Preston's name isn't on the public roster, and he's not allowed to get any financial aid for playing on the team. But I tell him that UCLA does count him in an unexpected way.
What's happening is that every year they count you guys, the scout team, toward women's participation in sports.
I did not know that. Wow. Well, that's weird. Well, I did not know that.
You're just a part of the women's basketball team.
Oh, wow. It's a privilege.
Preston and the other guys get bundled in with the female players in a report that the university submits to the government. Makai Ruddock and Malik Martin are also on the scout team.
I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, I have no problem with it because
I actually like helping them.
I kind of noticed, like, we really get counted as, like, part of the women's basketball team because we have, like, academic counselors and stuff. We can't drop classes unless we talk to our academic counselor, so that's pretty funny.
Okay, maybe it is kind of funny, but it's also misleading to count men as women. On its face, this report makes it look like UCLA is in compliance with the law. 56% of its student body are women, and the report makes clear about 56% of its athletes are women. This report we have is not the official document. We'll tell you about that one later. But it's the only public report where students, and for that matter, Congress, can verify how many men and women compete in college sports. Think of it as the first line of defense against unequal treatment of female athletes. Patrick Nero is the athletic director at George Washington University. About 10 years ago, he served on an NCAA committee that looked into the issue of male practice players.
There was the concern that this practice was going to take away opportunities for females.
The committee called on universities to ban male practice players because they said it violates the spirit of gender equity in Title IX. But universities never enforced the proposed ban. Plenty of schools still use male practice players. Some universities have practice squads that are even bigger than the women's team.
We should do everything we can to have an accurate account. The count is not accurate if you're counting men on women's teams as females.
But here's another interesting twist. If schools do use male practice players, the Department of Education says they have to count them as women. Okay, time to start checking the math. I'm actually going to write this down on a chalkboard so we can keep track. So UCLA says it has 495 people on all women's teams, 394 on all men's teams. That lines up with the percentage of men and women athletes they're supposed to have. Now let's subtract 28 male players who practice on all women's teams at UCLA. So now we're down to 467 women, 394 men. UCLA is still within a good range. So here's the thing. It's unlikely that UCLA is counting on male practice players to push it into a good range since they're a pretty small slice of the pie. But there's another number, a really big number, that jumped out at me. On the women's rowing team. UCLA reported 127 women on its team last year. That's almost twice the average number of rowers for a Division I team. Another red flag. The roster on the school's website says last year it only had 45 rowers. So, on a perfect spring day, I went to a race in Redwood Shores, Northern California, to see how many women were rowing that day. I met a super intense rowing mom decked out in Bruins blue and gold.
Hi! Way to go, girl!
How many people are on the team for UCLA this year? Do you know?
This year, I believe it's 50, approximately 50. That's the norm.
Joanne, the mom you just heard from, is well known by the other rowers. Before I could ask for her last name, voices from one of the UCLA boats on the water interrupt us. They're telling Joanne she can't talk to me without the coach's permission.
Oh, you're right. Did you speak with coach?
I didn't, but the race is public. I had requested an interview with the coach several times and always got no for an answer. I needed to talk to someone who was on the team practicing every day. So I got in touch with Ellie Berg, who rowed in the varsity and novice boats last year. She said there was nowhere near the 127 players UCLA reported. And the bus they rode to practice every day couldn't fit half those athletes.
It was one of those coach long-distance transportation type buses. So I would say probably 50 people at the most. It was pretty much full every day.
If Ellie's right, UCLA's numbers would be out of whack, but not necessarily unusual. Nancy Hogshead Maycar is a civil rights lawyer and the founder of Champion Women, a nonprofit that advocates for girls and women in sports. She has a name for what colleges might be doing.
Schools use a practice called roster management. It is artificially constricting the size of the men's teams and artificially inflating the size of the women's teams.
Adding players to a women's team can be legit if those athletes actually get a chance to participate. But Nancy says it's not okay if a school is adding them just to make things look right on paper.
It's essentially cheating. This is not being fair to women on campus.
Nancy was one of the first athletes to really benefit from Title IX. She got one of the first swimming scholarships at Duke, and then
Hogshead now has four Olympic medals here, three of them gold.
She won four medals at the 1984 Summer Olympics. But Nancy says recently there's been a standstill in momentum for college women athletes. She and her colleagues go through that same public report I've been mentioning from the Department of Education and count.
We have a project right now where we're sending out letters to the top 52 schools that are out of compliance with Title IX.
When schools miss their target for male and female athletes, they have some options. They can add another women's team, but that can be expensive. They can also cut men's teams. Let's get back to the UCLA rowing team. Like I mentioned before, the school lists 45 players on its online roster. That was in line with what a former rower told me. But UCLA also puts together a more complete document called the NCAA squad list. I finally got a hold of it through a California Public Records Act request a couple of days before wrapping the show. This is the official document we were talking about earlier, the one a federal investigator would use if a school was thought to be out of compliance. That list had 130 names on it, 85 more than the online roster. I decided to try to reach as many of those 85 people as I could. Were they on the team or not?
Did you ever attend a single day of practice?
No, I only tried out one day.
I thought drawing sounds pretty fun, so I tried out. So I'm not surprised I didn't pass it. Pretty much like any athletic-looking girl, they would kind of give them a flyer and tell them, hey, come to this like info session, and then you can like try out for the team.
Yeah, I was never on the team, so my name shouldn't be on any list.
So I reached 54 people on the list or their parents, and here's what I found. Some of them went to practice but never rode in a race. Some were on the team for part of the year and then they quit or maybe had an injury. But most of the people that I reached, more than two-thirds of them, were never on the team at all that year.
That story was from Reveal's Rachel DeLeon, and she joins me right now to do a final tally of UCLA's numbers. Okay, so Rachel, where we leave off?
All right, so we started off with 495. We took away the 28 male practice players already. So now we're going to have to subtract the women that were never on the rowing team. And remember, that totals 38.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got 28 plus 38 equals 66.
I'm glad you didn't ask me to do that because it wouldn't have been.
I'm going to ask you to do the next one. You ready?
Don't.
Okay, so we've got 66 spots now where we could fill with women.
Okay, so potentially those 66 women could actually be doing other sports like field hockey or rugby or something like that.
Right, exactly. So there's some sports that UCLA doesn't offer, for instance, field hockey, like you said, fencing or lacrosse. So this number is big enough, 66. You could actually add two of those three sports and have enough women to compete on them.
So is UCLA out of compliance here?
It's a good question, but we should emphasize that we don't know whether UCLA is out of compliance. Only the Federal Office of Civil Rights could determine that. But it's pretty clear that the average student, parent, congress member would probably have a hard time understanding these numbers.
All right, Rachel DeLeon of Reveal, thank you.
Thank you, Al.
We contacted UCLA for their response to this story. They maintain that they follow all of the rules for reporting athletic participation as established by the Department of Education. A fluorescent yellow softball sails out of the infield towards the woods by Ponagansett High School in Rhode Island. The left fielder runs forward and catches the ball. This is the home field for the Lady Chieftains. Turns out the team is not all ladies.
I'm Justin Benoyer and I'm playing outfield.
There's a lot evolving in the life of this 16-year-old with a shock of bleach blonde hair. Until a few weeks ago, his coaches knew Justin as Elise, although he'd already come out to most of his teammates.
I'm a guy. It's the same thing as if a guy who's not trans went and played on a girls' softball team.
Well, sort of. There are separate rules for transgender athletes. The rules are so different from state to state that some athletes, like Justin, can try out for any team they choose, while others would need full sex reassignment surgery before they sign up. Reporter Martha Biebinger of WBUR Boston brings us the story.
Justin Benoyer started telling close friends late last year that his true identity was male. He came out to his mom, Julie White, one day in the dead of winter, toward the end of the school lunch period.
I was working in the lunch line at Ponagansett. Mm-hmm.
Julie leaned over the metal counter to greet her child.
And walked up to me and said, "Mom, I have something to tell you. I am trans."
Friends had cheered as 5'5" Elise joined the wrestling team and won a few matches against bigger, heavier boys. Then last summer, at the beginning of her junior year, Elise decided to play football as the only girl on the team. Julie says coaches didn't return messages.
We showed up at practice, and basically you told them, "Hi, I'm here, I'm at practice," and you were a linebacker.
No, I wasn't.
What were you?
I was a lineman.
A lineman. So, yeah. Okay, I don't... Okay.
Now Justin looks ahead to suiting up for football in August as one of the boys. Not sure whether some of his teammates will object.
It could blow up in my face a bit because a lot of them are very conservative. I can't imagine that they would accept the fact that I'm coming out as trans.
Julie worries about her son in a small town where the short main street includes one of America's oldest general stores. But she's proud of Justin, too.
I really wish I had a quarter of my kid's confidence. At 16 years old, it takes my breath away.
Justin is exercising a little caution this spring. He chose softball over baseball because he thought the girls would be more accepting. Justin says many of the boys who refused to play with a girl on the football team last fall play baseball this season. For softball, Justin changes in the girls' locker room, where there are separate changing stalls.
It's uncomfortable, but I don't really want to change with the guys either, because a lot of them, like the ones from the football team, change in there, and I really don't want to be part of that or to start anything.
Justin may not be comfortable in a boys' locker room, but does he have a right to use it? Here's where Title IX comes in. Aaron Bazuvis, who teaches at Western New England University School of Law and writes about transgender issues, explains federal guidelines issued 2 years ago.
The Department of Education made clear that we have to respect people's gender identities because gender identity is a component of one's sex for purposes of Title IX.
While the Department of Education says Title IX protects transgender students from discrimination, most federal courts say it does not. But a few weeks ago, for the first time, a federal appeals panel in Virginia ruled in favor of a transgender student who wants to use the boys' room at his high school. Aaron Bazuvis says the right to bathrooms also should apply to locker rooms.
The decision gets us one step closer to a legal recognition of transgender students' rights to participate in sports according to their gender identity.
Fierce debates about this continue in many school districts. Jeremy Tedesco, an attorney at the conservative legal network Alliance Defending Freedom, says schools have the right to balance the needs of one student against many.
Everybody's privacy interests are paramount in these kinds of settings. And so the school can't just set aside all the girls in their school, their privacy interests, because they have a transgender boy who wants to use the girls' facilities.
That would be a transgender girl, not boy, in a girl's bathroom, according to the Department of Education guidelines. Tedesco says many schools would prefer that transgender students change in or use a single unisex bathroom. But the Federal Education Department has said that's not sufficient. It's threatened to withhold money from schools that do not let transgender girls into the girls' bathroom or transgender boys into the boys' room. That's a glimpse of the Title IX debate for disputes that will determine how schools treat trans athletes off the field. On the field, they face a whole other set of issues. Let's catch up with Justin's game.
Come out of the dugout like you want to play. Let's go. We jog out. The only one who walks is the pitcher. Come out of the dugout like you want to play. Jog deep positions. Let's go. Let's go.
Softball coach Mike Calenda found out that Elise was Justin almost by accident when Julie texted the coach to say she would be picking up her son Justin early one day. The coach told his team about the player's name change and his switch to male pronouns.
Most of our players, when I informed them
that Elise was now going to be called and referred to as Justin already knew and said, okay, coach, let's go.
So you were pretty much like the last to know?
Yeah, I was. I was one of the last.
Then coach gets serious about Justin, the athlete.
She can be who she wants to be, or he can be who he wants to, you know, he wants to be. Is that I look for players on the team. They're all, we treat them all the same. They're all players on our softball team.
Ball.
That pretty much reflects the Rhode Island Interscholastic League rules for transgender male athletes like Justin. They can play on any team they choose. Transgender girls, though, must request and be cleared by a panel to determine their eligibility before they can play on a girls' team. One former Pontagansett athlete helped draft the Rhode Island rules.
And the most valuable player in the tournament from Pontagansett High School, Jen Dandrow.
Point guard Jennifer Dandrow led the Pontagansett basketball team to a state championship in 1995. The same multi-sport athlete returned to the high school 5 years ago as coach Stephen Alexander. 38-year-old Stephen doesn't coach Justin, but they talk a lot. Stephen was the first trans person many students, teachers, and staff at Pontagansett had ever met.
Trans people can play sports. We can coach sports. You know, the stigma associated with us being amoral, immoral freaks is that's not. We're human beings that, you know, want a safe space to feel comfortable and to participate just like everybody else.
Transgender advocates consider Rhode Island an inclusive state. It's one of 15 in the country that do not require transgender high school athletes to take hormones or undergo sex reassignment surgery before they can play on the team they say fits their gender identity. The website transathlete.com shows 28 states with no or limited policies and 7 that require the full medical changes.
We've got complete and opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, there couldn't possibly be more different approaches.
Law professor Bazouvis says the states that do not allow transgender athletes to play on the team that fits their gender identity are in violation of Title IX. If transgender students can use the bathroom of their choice, she argues, then why not the playing court or field?
If you have a standard that says you have to allow transgender people to use the facility that matches their gender identity, to me, it's logical to extend that same definition of non-discrimination to include sports programs.
Tedesco, with the Alliance Defending Freedom, says that rationale is not fair.
If we interpret Title IX to allow gender identity as a protected classification, you're basically saying girls have to compete with boys for the girls' sports team. That's not what Title IX's about.
He calls them boys, but these players identify as girls. And in 15 states, they're allowed to play as girls. But let's dig into that point about competitive advantage. Just how much stronger is someone who goes through male versus female puberty? Dr. Joshua Safer heads the transgender medicine program at Boston Medical Center.
Men have about 15% more, when we're using kind of crude calculations, relative to women, of things that are associated with muscle mass.
During puberty, the doctor says, the average boy develops larger bones, longer limbs, and grows taller than someone going through a typical female puberty.
When a transgender girl, male to female, decides to transition, all those pieces are not necessarily going to be reversed. There's no way we're getting around that reality.
Keep in mind, he adds, there's already a big range in height and muscle mass among girls and among boys and on many sports teams.
And the fact that some of these transgender girls will be larger isn't going to be that relevant and isn't going to change the opportunity to get more girls out onto the field.
That prediction may spark heated discussions in many high schools. Transgender athletes will compel schools to answer lots of questions, some that fall under Title IX and many that don't. Pontagansett High School has a new gym with an old banner Coach Stephen Alexander wants to change. He looks up at his old name, Jen Dandrow, in red letters alongside other high point scorers. He's asked the school to change it for the name he uses now.
I think it's just time. It's my name I own it. The school has done so much for me, and I'd like to let people know somebody trans was here.
So far, the school has refused. Stephen scored all those points in basketball, as Jennifer. Stephen says maybe the solution is more co-ed sports, with teams based on athletes' size and physical or mental strengths.
These are the conversations that there were on the forefront about deconstructing sports and looking at it in a different way so that it reflects society. So when, you know, kids are growing up and they get into the workforce, it's everybody working together.
That would be a whole different era than the early 1970s, when pressure to boost women's and girls' opportunities in schools led to the passage of Title IX. Justin isn't counting on the law to smooth his path in life.
If somebody has a problem with me because of something that I did to hurt them, then I have an issue with that, and
yeah,
I'll feel bad, and I'll have to talk to them about it. But if somebody's not okay with the fact that I am trans or how I dress or the sports I play, that's their own problem, and that's their own views, and I'm not going to change that, so I'm just going to ignore it.
Justin says he's grateful for a boy on the football team who befriended him, for the band instructor who said he could wear a tux instead of a dress to the next performance, and for the friends who've defended him at school. For Justin, all signs of respect that no law can impose or enforce.
That story was from Martha Biebinger of WBUR Boston. Our lead producer for today's show is Rachel DeLeon, with help from Amy Walters and reporting from Annie Brown. Our senior editors this week are Cheryl Duvall and Andy Donahue. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Be sure to check out Israel Story. It's a new podcast from PRX and Tablet Magazine. It's hosted by Mishi Harman and is often called the Israeli This American Life. The show shines a light on the big and little dramas that comprise Israeli life, with stories ranging from the heartfelt to the hilarious, from the risque to the outright bizarre. Israel Story was named one of the podcasts that best helps us understand the world and has garnered much praise. I particularly enjoyed their episode called Love Syndrome, which tells the heart-wrenching tale of a mother who adopts one special needs baby after another. Check it out on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.